What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
How many discounts does USAA auto insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/auto discounts. Restrictions apply.
Ugh, you said you were over him, but his hoodie is still in your rotation. It's time. Grab your phone, snap a few pics, and sell it on Depop. Listed in minutes, with no selling fees. And just like that, a guy 500 miles away just paid full price for your closure. And right on cue.
Hey, still got my hoodie?
Nope, but I've got tonight's dinner paid for. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. List now with no selling fees. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Forbes Top 1 Million Podcasts, the Hunting Gear Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We appreciate your attendance. Thank you for turning your ears on to hunting gear and equipment. Today, we're going to be talking with Nate Sellers from Average Jack Archery. Here's the deal. Here's the buildup to this episode. I have been having issues tuning my bow since it was dropped on the concrete by an unintentional basketball bounce. It fell off the hook and it smashed down onto the concrete. I was not shooting well. And so I got a new sight. I had to have rest adjustments. I had to have cam adjustments. I had to basically start from scratch tuning and setting up my bow. I shot it through paper. I changed broadheads. I adjusted my nock position, just a whole bunch of different things. And finally, after doing all of those things over the course of the past 3 weeks, I have got to a point where yesterday I was shooting 60-yard groups about the size of a paper plate. Okay, some groups were a little bigger, or some groups were a little smaller, about the size of a softball. Other groups were in that paper plate size. And I'm calling that a success. Am I done for the year? No, absolutely not. I still have to get out there and do my reps and maybe even micro adjust a little bit. But now at this point, it's all about muscle memory. at this point, and just reps, getting reps in, and doing the thing that I love to do the best, and that's start at 40, 50, 60 yards and only shoot 40, 50, 60 yards. I don't care too much about the 30, the 20, 30, 40-ish range, because when you get that close, it just becomes a chip shot at that point. And so I'm really trying to hold on long distances and long ranges. And that's the goal too, that I've always found that has helped me get better, becoming a better shooter and holding and getting, make sure my sight picture is where it needs to be. And, you know, everything full draw, everything at full draw. So that's what I am, working on right now. Now, today's conversation with Nate, he's an experienced bow tech, and long story short, I'm asking him questions on what we as compound bow archers should be doing, bow hunters should be doing once we've identified a problem. Okay, my arrows aren't tuning. What should we do? It's time to troubleshoot, right? And we go through all the steps of what you should be doing when something like this happens. So that's what we're shooting for today. Now, this episode is also going to be launched on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast as well, because I feel it is very important to make sure that this is something that, I don't know about anybody else, but everybody else leading up into this, leading up into the archery season needs to be aware of, needs to hear, and don't just pick your bow up out of the case and take it hunting, right? That's a no-no, right? Something could have happened to it. You don't know. I'd hate for you to pull your bow back for the first time, like some of my family members do, and they some reason get lucky and can still kill. I do not recommend that. I do not recommend that. So before we get into today's episode, though, huge shout out to Code Blue Sense, huge shout out to Feed Hub by Moultrie Mobile, and huge shout out to Reveal Trail Cameras for supporting this podcast. All I'm asking for on this episode is that you do me a big favor and go check out these companies and their websites, okay? CodeBlueSense.com. Enter the discount code at checkout, NFC20. That's going to save you 20% off. Feed Hub. Now, this is a cellular device that connects to your SpinCast feeder that you can control through the Moultrie Mobile app. So go to MoultrieMobile.com and then find the Feed Hub and read up on that. And last but not least, Reveal Trail Cameras. They have the new 3.0 version. And now every day I'm starting to get a little more and a little more pictures of deer, you know, meandering through the terrain. So there's that. And that would be at tacticam.com. And then you just go to cameras. All right. So Reveal 3.0. We got the Feed Hub and we have Code Blue Sense. Go check those out. I would really appreciate that. Good vibes right now. Good vibes in, good vibes out, and enjoy today's Hunting Gear podcast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we are joined by Nate Sellers of Average Jack Archery, and you do some other stuff too with Huntworth. Do you work for Huntworth, or what's your main gig?
My main gig is Huntworth, yeah, okay. Marketing right. Department of Huntworth.
Okay, and so Average Jack Archery is what?
Average Jack Archery is a full pro shopping range in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania, right in center of the state, right in the middle of the rectangle. And we have a really nice facility. It's just my wife and I that own the store, and we haven't been in business since 2022, but I've been working on bows and for all everybody around shops around Pennsylvania for about 15 years now. So I've been around.
Good. And that's your qualification for today's episode, because we're going to talk into we're going to get into the details of troubleshooting your archery equipment. And before we get into the meat and potatoes of this episode, though, I got to ask you a question. How many times a year is your patience tested with customers or people who bring their bow into you because they don't have the vocabulary or they are dumb.
Yeah. I mean, so I would say it's about, you know, I'm open 365 days a year, right? Pretty much, you know, I'm a 12-month proposition. And I would say probably about 200 days out of the year, somebody says something asinine. But I don't hold it against him, because there's two different types of people. There are people that have had bad experiences in the past with their shop or with any shop. Yep. And their shop didn't know anything. So they feel like they have to learn everything about their bow and then come in and then tell me, the new shop person they're experiencing, what their bow is all about. Yeah. And because they don't know. They don't know what I know or how informed I am. And then there are people that just have no clue. They yeah. think that the number on the arrow is how much the arrow weighs. They don't know that that's the spine of the arrow. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, well, I've been shooting 90 grain broadheads. And I'm like, I don't think I've ever even heard of a 90 grain broadhead outside of like 1987. So no, you're probably shooting 100 grain, you know? So yeah. it's two sides. One is very harmless and they're just trying to do the best they can. And one is just complete ignorance, but
yeah.
it is what it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're getting ready to talk to one of the most ignorant archers that there is. And that's me. Okay. So, that's funny. That's almost like the title of a show. That should be the title of a podcast, The Ignorant Archer.
The Ignorant Archer. That's there good.
Go. Yep. And I would host it like I do all the other nonsense that I host. So, all right, here's the background. Everybody has already heard this story, but I'm telling you. I'm upstairs in my office. I'm working. I hear a basketball dribbling in my garage. My garage is underneath my office. And I hear a crash. I go down to investigate. My bow is on my garage floor. I look at it. I do a quick once over. I don't know. It looks okay. I take it out that evening to shoot, and things are off. Okay. Start to adjust my sight. Things are off. Start to adjust my my sight a little more. Still shooting off to the left. All right. Up and down. I feel like I'm good. However, the weird thing is that I'm shooting the same distance left at 40 yards that I am at 50 and 60 yards, okay? So it's not like multiplied the further back I get. I continue to adjust my sight, and I am at this point pegged out. I cannot adjust my sight any further left, all right? And so now I'm kind of in an oh shit moment. And then I look at my sight housing that goes around my pins, and it looks to be oblong, and there's a scuff on it to the point where it looks like maybe my sight, it dropped on my sight. Okay. Buy a new sight. Same exact thing starts happening there. Okay. I take my bow in, and they see that my rest is now off. My arrow is not equal with my riser, meaning the front end of my arrow is closer to the riser than the back end of my arrow. My string, my cams are off as well. And so now I am at kind of a, oh shit, I've never had to do any of this tuning myself type of moment. And now it's time to start troubleshooting. Okay. So the stage is set. All right, Nate Sellers, what should a person do when they are starting to have problems with their bow and they cannot figure out? It goes deeper than just making adjustments on your sight.
So first and foremost, let's make something very clear. It's not too complicated. Actually, I would say it's not complicated at all. A bow is a very simple machine. People get wigged out on their bows. They think it is this massively crazy, wild thing, and it's just not. It's just really not. So let's first, anybody listening, I want to make that very clear. Working on a bow is not that complicated. Otherwise, average people such as myself couldn't figure this out. But realistically, before anything goes amok, the very first thing is when something gets set up and it feels right and it's shooting right, you've got it sighted in, the group is good. I'd say the first thing ever, and I do this with every single bow, whether it's a target bow, a hunting bow, I'm shooting field points, broadheads, whatever. I take a measuring tape and I just measure everything. Axle to axle length. Measure the rest. Like you described with the arrow, right? Measure your center shot. How is it from the front of the arrow, you know, back of the arrow, depending on the shelf or whatever. measure the distance between the peep and the D-loop, the kisser button, the nose button, whatever. Take all those measurements and write it down and put it on a piece of paper. Then I keep that piece of paper in my bow case. And at any point, my bow falls over. My buddy says he accidentally dropped it. It made a weird noise on a shot. Maybe a nock was broken or something like that. I pull out a measuring tape and I check everything. And I look at that piece of paper and say, okay, when this was set up 3 months ago, 4 months ago, in the spring, in the summer, whatever, and I compare, is everything okay? If everything is the same and something is off, now I got to take it to a shop. If something is off, though, I have a reference mark. And you can do something as easy as take a silver Sharpie or a pencil and start to make marks on where your rest lines up, you know, exactly where your sight sits, where your cam leans. You can, I mean, there's no wrong measurement. And if you do that, then you have at least a reference point, right? You're like, I think my sight looks oblong. I think my sight's broken. Well, if you don't know what the distance of this to this or whatever, then you don't have a before and after. So that's a first thing to do. But let's say, you know, so you've got it, your shop, you got a problem and your shop is taking care of it. And it looks like you're back to doing normal. And now you're like, oh, crap, I'm starting at square one in September, the whatever. OK, the first thing I recommend is if you can shoot through paper, if you can. But sometimes that's even intimidating to people. So then the next easier thing is to do group tuning. So what you were having was a classic example of you have two ways. You're either always left or it makes what I call the Christmas tree. So at 20 yards, maybe you'll be a little bit to the left or right. And then at 30 yards, it keeps going, and at 40 and 50. And it actually just keeps getting worse and worse. If at the first one, it's just staying in a line, but it's always left, we can play with the sight on that one, in particular if it's a new sight, or we can bump the rest. It's counterintuitive, believe it or not. It's counterintuitive to think, okay, if I'm shooting to the left, I should probably move my rest where the arrow is actually making contact. I need to move that to the right to kick the arrow. It's actually the opposite. You actually need to chase where your arrow is going with the rest. So if you're hitting to the left, you're going to move your rest to the left. It sounds super weird. It's super counterintuitive, but it's actually what you need to do. And if you have that straight line and everything's left, you can try that as well. But in particular, if you've got that Christmas tree look and it just keeps getting further and further to the right or further and further to the left as you go back, that's called a group tuning issue. And so you know that the arrow is not coming off the bow consistently like you would if they were all just straight left or straight right. And so now you definitely need to move your rest a little bit. And again, it's counterintuitive. You're actually going to move it in the direction that the arrow is already going. There's no need to explain that. That's the non-simple machine part of the bow. But that little simple thing, even if you're not shooting through paper, you're not bare shaft tuning, that little simple, it's called a French tune or a walk back tune. It's kind of, it's not as popular as it used to be, but that, even if it wouldn't shoot perfectly clean through paper or wouldn't shoot a perfect, you know, exact perfect group that you usually shoot, that will get you 90% of the way there. And that could totally save your season because you could drop it out of the middle of the tree in November. You're somewhere on a 3-day, you know, Iowa rut hunt or an Illinois rut hunt or an Indiana rut hunt. You don't have time to be shooting it through paper. You don't have time to get to a shop. You're just taking it out in the yard of the Airbnb with your target. And you've got to make those rest movements again to get that arrow to fly straight. And so that French tune, that walk back tune could really be a bacon saver. And particularly if you don't feel confident messing with anything else but the rest and the sight.
Yeah. So up until recently, I have never shot through paper. And when I say recent, I mean as far as 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago was the first time I ever shot through paper. And talk to us a little bit about the importance of shooting through paper.
So when an arrow comes out of a bow, the ideal situation is that arrow is flying exactly straight out of the bow. And the fletchings, which are on the back end, don't have to do any extra correcting. That's the whole point of the fletchings on an arrow. I describe it a lot when we were kids, you know, guys of our age group who would play with the old Nerf balls, or it was a football, then it had the arrow coming out the back and usually whistled through the air, right? So that allowed it to go for miles. It had really good accuracy. You always could throw a perfect spiral. An arrow is the exact same way. You have the weight on the front end, and that back end is just spinning and controlling the whole tube. If your arrow is coming out straight, then those fletchings or feathers, whatever, can automatically start turning and controlling that arrow immediately. But if the arrow is coming out at an angle, any way, shape, or form, up, down, left, right, doesn't matter, then the fletchings are like, let's get the end back to center. And so now you have a little bit extra. And when you are changing, again, try not to get too much into the weeds, but when you take the energy from straight to sideways, you're actually losing energy, which then loses speed, loses penetration, you know, kinetic energy, momentum, all that sort of stuff. So if we can, when we shoot through paper, see what we describe as a bullet hole, you have a perfect circle from where the shaft goes through, and then whatever fletching configuration you have, a three or a four. So let's say it's a three. You got a perfect circle in the middle, one fletching, two fletching, three fletching. If you have that through paper, and I'm talking, you're standing about 8 feet away from the paper, nice taut piece of any kind of thicker paper, copier paper, butcher paper, whatever. You see that through that paper. Now you know that arrow is coming out perfectly straight. Those fletchings are going to take over immediately. They're going to start spinning that arrow and controlling that arrow, and therefore being able to easily control broadheads and other big things on the front, which are also mini fletchings. So if you can give the bigger fletchings on the back end more control of those little mini fletchings on the front, you're going to have a much more accurate setup, a much more forgiving setup, and overall increase your speed a little bit and your penetration as well downrange.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I did that. Let's say a guy does that. He goes, he shoots through paper. Okay. And now maybe the range that here, I'm just talking about my experience. The range is 10 yards where I get my bow. They don't have anything longer than that where I get my bow tuned. And so they go, okay, well, it's coming off straight here. The measurements are good on our end here. Now it's time to go home and shoot again. Okay. So the rest is equal now. The measurements are equal now. The paper, I'm shooting bullet holes through paper. Okay. I get home, still shooting left at this point. Okay. And so I call the bow shop. And they tell me I have something, I shoot a Bowtech solution, and so it has that that deadlock technology where it allows me to move the cams back and forth on the axle. Is that something that I had to do to get my broadhead shooting, like my broadhead shooting straight? Or is there another underlying issue before you start messing with where the cams on the bow?
So you can get a bullet hole through paper with a bow that is, there's something wrong with it. So a bullet hole through paper just lets us know that arrow is coming out straight. It does not mean that what we are doing is perfect. So for example, if you have a bow that's out in front of you and you're torquing it, let's just say you're adding some sort of torque. And when you add torque, that causes the arrow to fly left or right off the bow, depending on which way you're torquing it, thumb side or your pinky side, whichever one. You do that, you can still get a bullet hole through paper, but what you've done is you might have moved the rest way too far to the left. Maybe you have pushed the cams too far to the right or whatever direction it may be. So you might have a good bullet hole through paper, but you actually are not still set up for success. So now you have to kind of look at the Indian, not the bow, right? I know it's probably not politically correct, but you know, we were raised in the 80s and 90s. That's what I was taught. So there's so many different variables with the archer. So a lot of things then at that point, if I'm getting a bullet hole through paper and I'm still left, usually it's enough to do with the sight. And then I can work with the archer on that grip a little bit. You'd be amazed. Absolutely amazed. I know it's close. It's close to the beginning of season. You don't want to change anything up, but you would be amazed how a little bit of grip pressure could totally affect the size and the shape of your groups downrange. You'd be very, very surprised. And that's something in my own personal shop, I deal with, I would say arguably 8 to 10 customers a week I'm dealing with in terms of grip pressure, how that works on the tuning, because usually that affects the tune first, but then it desperately or devastatingly rather has an effect on your group shape and your group size downrange.
Gotcha. Okay. And so that's kind of what I did. I went in, I started messing with the cams. Now, what happens when you start to adjust one thing and you're starting to get a different result? Like, how do you find the balance in adjusting a rest and a sight and cams and cam timing and your grip? Like, I'll take one step back. In an equation, in a mathematical equation, even if you change one little thing, the outcome of that equation changes, right? So how do you find the variable in that equation, and how do you keep it the variable so that the rest of the other parts of the equation aren't changing so that the outcome is darts downrange?
So that's a great question. I explain this to people weekly in my shop. There are four variables to a bow and to a shooting situation: the archer, the bow, the arrow, and then the release and rest combination, depending on how you do, which one you want to look at, right? Yep. So those are the four things that have to move. They are the four things that have to do something for an arrow to go downrange. Three of them are simple machines, and one of them is a pile of redundant protoplasm, aka the person, okay? Yep. The three things that are simple machines are made out of metal and super stable and everything else. The person can be changed moment to moment. So the big thing for me is when engineers design arrows and they design bows and design releases and design all that sort of stuff, they're specifically designing with, we're going to do this with it. And we want it to be set up like this. We want the draw stops to be hitting at the exact same time. We want the cams to be here. We want the rest at 13 16ths, whatever. They're making that machine with that in mind, with very high tolerance. You as an individual are not a very high tolerance. You're very floppy, for lack of a better term. So what I do with the bow is I'm going to set up that bow the way that engineer designed that simple machine to be. And I'm going to see what I as the human can do to change myself, because I can't change the bow. I can't machine off parts of the riser. I can't make the limbs wider. I can't make the arrow a different diameter of carbon. I have zero control over any of that. I only have control of this. So if I can set up those simple machines to be the engineering way they were supposed to be, and then play with my, you know, with my grip and my face pressure, my release and the rest in terms of, you know, what type of rest I'm using, whisker biscuit or drop away, whatever's going to work best with me as the archer. Those are things I look at first, because the bow can only do the same thing. Just sends an arrow down range. That's all it does. It doesn't do anything different. You are the person that bends it and twists it and torques it and tweaks and twitches and everything. So focusing more at me at 10 yards and seeing what kind of little effects that I have on the bow drastically affect, you know, how I'm going to then tune the bow after I figured out me, which is behind it.
Gotcha. All right. So at what point then, like, what are some examples of, hey, maybe this is a little bit bigger of a issue than just making sure that you're shooting dots through paper, your measurements are right. When should we start being concerned that we have a bigger problem, like a bent riser or bent cams, or what are some key indicators there?
So that's really good question, because there sometimes, even as a shop owner, it's not physically obvious. Sometimes you have an issue and it's not obvious. For example, a big thing is like cam bearings or cam bushings. They can crack, the covers can go, the grease could, you know, or the lubricant that you put in it could leak out. You would never know. And so what that's actually doing is sometimes one cam is moving faster than the other, and you'll get some weird tears, or maybe the bow make weird noises, it'll click and stuff like that. And you're like, yeah, it doesn't sound right. That's something that needs addressed, that you can't overtune that. You can't outdo something that is broken or breaking. There's nothing you could do about that. When it comes to things like bent risers, we don't see that as much. Definitely limbs. We have seen sometimes where out of the factory, a bow will have, you know, accidentally, obviously there's tolerances on limbs. They'll put two weak limbs together and two strong limbs together, because most bows have four limbs nowadays. And so now you're like, one cam will be really twisted this way and the other cam really twisted this way. And like, you can't overdo that. The bow has to be broken down, put weak with strong and strong with weak or whatever, and make that happen. When you start to tune, or you start to have groups and you're working with it and you just can't get it to move, right? You're trying to shoot through paper, it won't move. You're moving the cams with that deadlock situation and the tear won't move, or the groups won't move. It's always, 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 always left. Then you might actually have a structural issue that you've tried everything and the normal things, rest movement, sight movement, cam movement, nothing is changing. You might have a structural deformation that you can't see, you can't hear, you can't feel, but it's present. Could be a limb, could be a cam, could be a bearing, could be a roller guard, and you don't necessarily know until you start playing with it some more.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Before we move on to my next question, what are some other things that we need to be aware of when tuning our bows if we're not getting the groupings that we want, or some things that we should maybe be observant of on the bow specifically?
So group size has everything to do with the accuracy of what you're seeing. Yeah. So I strongly recommend three things: making sure you have a pin size that suits your eyeball. So I have crap vision. Well, I shouldn't say crap vision. My vision is not great compared to what it used to be. So I can't see like a 10,000th pin anymore. I can kind of see a 15, 19 is a good sweet spot for me. But now I can't see orange like I used to. So I predominantly stick to red and green. So making sure you have a pin color you can see, that greatly affects your accuracy. Also shooting at dots that are a little bit smaller than you think they should be. When you shoot a nice big 6-inch dot, you're like, that's good enough for me. But if you're not forcing yourself to stick to a 3-inch circle, a 2-inch circle, a 1-inch circle, you'd be surprised how nonchalant you will be with your accuracy. The biggest thing, though, when it affects accuracy is a lot of guys think, I need a big peak so I can let in all this light. So that way, in a low light situation, I can see my pins. Well, that's all well and good. But what you'll actually have is you'll have a peak that's so big that around your sight housing, there's so much air. Okay. So when you have a ring on a ring, your sight housing can then fill in that space incorrectly. So it could be really far on the left side, really far on the right side, really high, really low. It's inside your peep, but it is too inside of your peep. That means there's too much wiggle room. There's too much variance. So now you get some weird left and right misses, some weird up and down misses, because your peep can't be better lined up with the sight housing of the ball. I see it all the time. Guys love shooting quarter inch peeps. Quarter inch peeps for most guys are too big. You really should be down to a 3/16, because if you have too much air around your sight housing, then you have too much variance of where you could put that pin on, left, right, up, down, and you'd be amazed at 25, 30 yards, how your groups will start to open up, and at 40, 45 in particular. So think about maybe necking down your peep size.
Okay. All right. How do I know whether my bow is the issue or my arrow is the issue?
The arrow question. That's a great one. The old arrow, man. I've lost sleep over this one. If you are shooting what I call a bell curve style arrow, so when I say a bell curve, I'll go back to statistics class in senior year of high school, right, where everybody falls into a bell curve, you know, and you have like 75% of people live inside the bell curve. When arrows are designed that you look at a spine chart, you go, here's my draw length, here's my draw weight, I'm shooting 100 or 125 grain point, and this is the arrow spine I should be shooting. So for me, 3160, 3170, something like that, 125 grain point, I should be shooting a 300 spine. If I take that arrow and I cut it to 31 inches and I put 125 grain, normal insert, blah, 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 and I shoot it and I can get that arrow to tune, I know any problems are my problem. The bow can clearly handle that. Everything is going okay there, all right? If I built something that was outside the bell curve, let's say I wanted to make a 900 grain arrow and I put 400 grains into a front end of a 150 spine and I can't get it to tune, who knows what it is? Is that the arrow? Is that the bow? I don't know. You have to have a baseline. And the baseline is what a manufacturer expects you to shoot first, which is what I call that bell curve style arrow. Most guys shooting anywhere between 28 to 29 and a half inches of draw are shooting a 340, 350 spine arrow, 330 maybe if they want to shoot like an older one, right? If you can take that, whatever that spine chart says for you at 50, 60, 70 pounds, your draw length, draw weight, and you can get that arrow to tune, then you know it's not the bow. The bow is doing exactly what manufacturers had in mind for that bow. And then you can go and do other things with other arrows. You want to build something super light, you want to go build something super heavy. If you can't get that bell curve style arrow to tune, and you've moved your rest and you've moved your cams and you've done this and you've done that, now it's become the Indian. It's not the bow. But if you can get that normal arrow to tune with the bow set up the way the manufacturer recommends, it's definitely then you're free to go do whatever you want and try whatever you want. But if you can do everything with the bow and nothing changes, most of the time, I would say 99 times out of 100, before we think structural deformation of the bow, it's the Indian, not the bow.
All right, so everybody, we already know if your arrow's too light, it can cause problems. You know, coming out of a rocket launcher, you know, bend in the arrow, all this stuff, whatever. Can an arrow be too heavy?
My day kicks off with a refreshing Celsius energy drink, then straight to the gym. pre-K pickup, back home to meal prep. Time for my fire station shift. One more Celsius, gotta keep the lights on. When the 3-alarm hits, I'm ready. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I would say yes. Okay. There are others that disagree, but I would say yes.
And why is that?
Because there are points of diminishing returns both directions, right? Again, the bell curve, all right? So if you build something really heavy, that's all well and good. But now you've lost a lot of velocity. Also, you'll start to get to a point where you lose so much velocity but don't gain anything in terms of kinetic energy or momentum. You know, the laws of supply and demand. It's that intersecting graph. You want to be right in that sweet spot. Same thing is true the other way. You can have an arrow that gets super light and super fast, but eventually you start losing kinetic energy and momentum. You start losing it quicker than you start gaining speed. So again, there's a sweet spot for a light arrow. And yeah, and a lot of people have spent a lot of time debating that one way or other, but that's just the laws of nature. There's nothing okay. You can do to refute it.
I'm going to tell you my setup right now. 30-inch draw, okay, 70 pounds. I have a drop-away rest. I have a 4-fletch arrow. My total arrow weight is, depending on what head I decide to go with, right? I'm still debating that. I still think my broadhead might be part of this issue as far as tuning it, okay? I'm 100 grain versus a 125 grain. My total arrow weight is going to be 550 or 575 by the end of this. Is my arrow, in your opinion, too heavy for my draw and poundage?
No.
No. Okay. All right.
No, that's totally normal. That's totally normal. It's definitely on the heavier side. Yeah. Now, what tube are you shooting? It sounds like you would have to have a decently high GPI tube, actual arrow itself.
Yeah. So I'm shooting a day 6 arrow.
Oh yeah. So it's going to be heavier. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So that makes sense, right? That makes sense.
Yeah. So when it comes to shooting heavier arrows, when would you run into tuning issues on a heavier arrow?
So you start running into tuning issues on a heavier arrow when you start jumping bell curve spines. So for example, I live in a bell curve arrow and I see this every day in my store, right? People think, you know, I blow smoke when I say this sort of stuff, but I do this for a living. You know, so I live in a 300 spine. That's where I'm at. That's where you're at, right? That we know 300 spine arrows. But let's say I want to build something that I'm going to put a whole bunch of weight into the front end of the arrow, right? You're not going to add weight to the back end. That's stupid. You're going to add weight to the front end. So therefore, I need to go into a 250 spine. Well, in order for me to get into a 250 spine, I'm now building an arrow that's outside of that bell curve. I'm now pushing myself towards the heavy end. That's not what, you know, when bow and arrow manufacturers made my bow and arrow setup, they weren't intending me to add this whole bunch of weight and jump up in spine. Okay, they weren't intending, and vice versa. Let's say I was going to try to shoot a very light arrow very quickly. Well, I can't do that with a 300 spine arrow. They're pretty heavy. So I need to jump down to a 340 or a 400 spine. Again, I'm shooting very light. I'm shooting very fast. But my bow is not designed to be shooting with that light of a spine. So now I'm getting erratic flight and erratic tuning. So as soon as you start jumping one direction or the other with your spine outside of what is expected, you may or may not experience tuning issues. And then, of course, you really start going, you know, let's say I go from a 250 to a 200, or I go from a 350 to a 400 to a 450. The further you get away from where your home base, if you will, the harder and harder it becomes to have a consistent bow and arrow setup that can tune well.
Yeah. Is there any documents out there that say, okay, if I'm shooting 30-inch draw and I'm shooting a 70-pound bow, this is the ideal bow hunting? And what I mean by that is North American animals, right? Obviously, elk is bigger than a whitetail, right? Is there any documentation up there to where a guy who has extreme knowledge of archery could say, this is what you need. Here are the specs. You should have this total arrow weight with this this number of fletchings and this spine and things like that.
So I don't know if anybody actually has it documented. I've often been tempted to write it down, you know, like my thoughts and what I've done and my experience on setting up arrows for people and building stuff. And, you know, I just had somebody text me the other day. I set a father-son combo up and they went to Colorado. They both shot elk with normal bell curve style arrows that I set up for them in the shop. So what my mentality is I pick an arrow, I pick, let's say, for example, I have a guy who's our size and I say, okay, here are the most common arrows that you might find in a bow shop. Okay. Cause that's where most guys are going to buy their arrows. They're going to go into a local shop or their Lancaster, Bass Pro, whatever. Here's your lightest GPI or grains per inch arrow. And here's your heaviest GPI grains per inch arrow. And then I put 100 grain point up to 125 grain point on. And I just assume based on that. So let's say we have a 30 inch draw, 70 pounds or a 300 spine. The lightest arrow I know of is 7.7 GPI. Multiply that by 30, add your inserts, knocks, fletchings, whatever. That's the lightest arrow I expect Dan Johnson to be shooting. Then I go over here. Here's the heaviest GPI arrow, like your day six. And I add all the components there together with 125 grain point. And I say, this is the heaviest arrow I expect you to be shooting. That's your bell curve. Gotcha. Right. So that's the bell curve base. And it changes per person, right? Because sometimes I have gals who are like 6 foot, but they can only pull 40 pounds. So now they're 40 pounds at like a 30 inch draw, right? That changes the dynamic of their spine a little bit based on the length of the arrow. So there's so many variables with it, but predominantly I say, what are the arrows that are the most readily available at the lowest GPI that's safe and the highest GPI that's safe? And I build an arrow, a bell curve style arrow based off of that. And I say, okay, this is the range. And if you come into my shop and I build you an arrow that's in that range, whether it's on the high end, the middle or the low end, I feel very confident and comfortable. Yep. You can go take a whitetail down. I mean, that's what we're hunting here. Whitetail, I'm elk. I'm setting up guys for elk. I'm setting up guys for pronghorn and mule deer. Any kind of North American big game like that. If you stick within that method that I kind of mentally run through every time a person comes into the shop, I feel very confident in your abilities.
Does that bell curve change by species?
No.
No.
No, okay. I just know. I know here's the heavy end. Here's the low end. So, for example, your arrow would be on the heavy end of a GPI with 125 grain point, 575 at 3070. I'm in the same boat. I'm 3170. My arrow right now is 517. And I like to say it's without us even trying. We're not doing anything special. You're not putting a 200 grain broadhead up there. You're not throwing weight tubes in the shaft. You just took an arrow, cut it, insert it, knock point fletchings. That's all you did. Nothing, right. Nothing crazy. And when you do that, that's what arrow manufacturers expect. So you're on the heavy end, but you could have also taken, let's say, like a gold tip hunter at like 9.3 GPI with a 12 grade insert and 100 grain point. That arrow would weigh around 450. So that's yours and my light end, right? 430 to 450, high end 575. So if I'm thinking whitetail, be anywhere. Elk, we might want to try to think about going to an arrow that's a little bit heavier. That day six is, I think, what? It's a 5 mil. It's a little bit smaller in diameter as well.
Yeah.
Or is it a stand? Yeah. So you're increasing penetration there. So within that bell curve, I'm like, I know we can get this to tune because it's a normally built arrow. I know we can get this lighter arrow to tune because it's a normally built arrow. But if we're going to go towards elk, maybe we want to go a little bit heavier. But we're still staying within that bell curve overall.
Gotcha. Okay. The next portion of this conversation then becomes about broadheads. I have seen... You're like, anybody, let's say we figured it out with our field tips, all right? We're shooting really good groups all the way back to 60 yards, whatever the case is. You know, we're starting to feel confident. Now we put our broadheads on, and my buddy Fred from Wasp, I love the guy. He says to me, and this is something that I have taken with me of all the years of talking to people, he goes, a mechanical, they may say it flies just like a field point, but it is not a field point. And all all broadheads, mechanical or fixed, need to be tuned separately. Okay, so I've always taken that, and I've always tuned my broadheads. Are there broadheads though out there that maybe they're a 3-blade or a 4-blade, or maybe there is a 4-blade with a 4-blade fletch, or a 3-blade with a 3-blade fletch, or whatever combination? Are there combinations out there that are harder to tune and have an arrow flying straight than others?
Oh yeah, and there are certain ones that are way easy to tune. So for Wasp broadheads, great broadheads, right here out of Harrisburg, made up in Connecticut. Great broadhead. I sell a pile of Wasp drones, Wasp jackhammers. I don't have people come back and complain that they can't get their stuff to fly like a field point, right? But most people, to be fair, in the general whitetail woods east of the Mississippi River are not that in tune with their normal accuracy. If they can hold a snuff can size group at 20 yards, they're over the moon. Six inches at 40, and it's like, it's heaven. So if their broadhead's close enough to that, then it flew like a field point. But I 100% agree that actual field point-like accuracy is not usually achievable right out of the package. Sometimes you have to do a little bit of tweaking. It's going to be pretty dang close if you do it right to start. But yeah, there are certain broadheads. If you take a big four-blade fixed blade, I think of something like the Magnus Black Hornet, which is 1¼" by 7/8", or like the Slick Trick Grizz Trick or Slick Trick Magnum, which are 1⅛" by 1⅛". So that's a lot of resistance out on the front end. Now, I'm not an aerospace engineer, so I don't know all the terminology of it, but that's a lot of initial air cutting it's doing, and it can push itself in one direction or the other. And if you don't have enough fletching on the back end, it won't have enough to correct it, like we were talking about earlier. If you don't have enough fletching on the back end, that arrow's not coming out straight, the fletchings are actually going to lose the battle to the broadhead. I actually saw this just the other week. I had a guy went and shoot Black Hornets, and he was shooting little tiny X vanes, little X3 vanes. They were like 1¾". He was using 3 of them. He's like, well, last year they flew my mechanicals just fine. I said, yeah, because your mechanical's almost like a field point. Now you're putting a big cut fixed blade. Or like I said, like the Slick Trick Magnum or something like that, the big cutting ones. But if you stick to a normal style broadhead, and I really think a lot of people are starting to gravitate away from the 3-blades. You still have a fair amount of guys that shoot the Q80 Exodus. That's a great head. The G5 Striker, the G5 Montech, those are great head. The Wasp Drone's a great head. That's a 3-blade, the original style. And there, if you stick to a smaller cut, I think you'll get away with it. 1⅛", 1⅙". When you start getting to 1⅓", you start getting to 1¼", you start getting to 1½", you better buckle up and be along for the ride, because unless you got enough fletching on the back end or your bow is really well tuned, you may or may not have a hair pulling contest to see if you can get those broadheads to fly right.
Yeah. So you're saying that are you saying that the more blades up front are better or harder to tune?
They are harder if they start getting bigger.
Okay.
If you start getting bigger. So like the Slick Trick Standard, it's 1 inch by 1 inch. The Wasp, I think it's the Dart, which is 1⅛ by 1⅛". You would think that extra 1/8 of an inch is not that big of a deal. I have maybe almost like a 99% success rate with flight out of crossbows, compounds, recurves with that 1 inch by 1 inch. But that Wasp Dart is not that same level. And that's nothing against the Dart. It's a great broadhead. But that little bit of extra size with a 4-blade, I like to stick it down. So,
you
I want to see
boss,
like that.
The Boss 4-blade, right?
Or whatever's 1⅛ by 1⅛".
Yeah.
There's a broadhead that Wasp makes. Grim Reaper makes one too in the Hades, 1⅛ by 1⅛", 4-blade Hades. That's another one that can be difficult to tune. Just because you just add a lot of surface area. So if you're going to shoot a 3-blade, a 4-blade, or a 2-blade, I strongly recommend 1¼" if it's going to be at the most, but then small bleeders, because if you start putting all that extra up there, I don't care. You could have 6 vanes on the back end. Something's could potentially be amok, and I just don't want to deal with that. And I know my customers don't want to deal with that either. You never want to have that little thing living in the back of your head. Well, man, I spent a lot of time tuning this. I hope nothing went awry because I left my bow in the truck accidentally overnight or something, and the strings did something weird. Now my broadhead's going to fly like a corkscrew. You never want that. And you'll set yourself up for success if you just stick to a little bit of a smaller cut or go with mechanical, which there are a lot of great mechanicals out there too.
Yeah. And so I shoot a four blade. Like I've been trying, I've been messing around with a four blade fixed. Here today, after we get done recording, I'm going to try a three blade fixed, and I'm basically just going to, I'm testing out to see what I want to, what direction I want to go in. Is there such thing as having too much fletch for your arrow on the back end?
So you'll get an effect, what's called parachuting. And what that basically means is if you have so much, you know, drag or spin on the back end of the arrow, eventually the arrow slows down so much that it's spinning harder on the back end than it's traveling forward. And so the arrow will start to actually, you know, kind of corkscrew the point, and the fletching will start to go, well, it looks like opposite, but it's going in the same direction as itself. And that's called parachuting. You won't really experience parachuting though, up to 40 yards. I don't care how much fletching you put on the back end. The arrow is still on a normal compound. You're talking 200 some odd feet a second, wherever, up to 300 some odd feet a second. You're not going to get parachuting out to 40 yards, but after 40 yards, 45, 50, 55, 60, because the arrow is going to start to slow down and you might have too much drag on the back end, you might start seeing that parachuting. And that does, that opens up your groups drastically, because now you've lost, the arrow has lost its trajectory control, and now it's just trying to slow down and fight gravity.
How do you identify parachuting?
Well, the holidays have come and gone once again, but if you've forgotten to get that special someone in your life a gift, well, Mint Mobile is extending their holiday offer of half off unlimited wireless. So here's the idea. You get it now. You call it an early present for next year. What do you have to lose?
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time 50% off regular price for new customers. Upfront payment required. $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds may slow after 50 gigabytes per month when network is busy. See terms.
Oh, you'll see it. Like if you're out in the backyard, you're out at the local range and you're shooting long distance again, you won't see parachuting under 40 yards. I've never seen it in my lifetime. And I've been around thousands of archers for over 20 years. It's after 45, 45, 50, 55, 60. You'll shoot, you'll watch your arrow, and then all of a sudden your arrow will look like it just like hangs in the balance for a second. And that's because it's kind of losing velocity faster than it's picking it up again, right? Because it's really quick coming out of the bow, and it doesn't lose velocity very quickly till it hits about 35, 40 yards. And then it starts to slow down. But then the fletchings will be so aggressive, your arrow will get there, and all of a sudden it'll start doing this. It will literally start corkscrewing. It'll make a big oval-looking shape through the air at the back end. It'll go from this nice flying, you know, you can see the colors of the fletchings, and all of a sudden it'll just like it hangs in the air, and then it has a big wobble and hits the target kind of weird. And that's how you know you're getting parachuting. And also your group's downrange. Like if you get parachuting, your group could be amazing at 45, and then at 50 it goes from like 5 inches to a foot. You're like, what the heck's going on? That felt like a good shot. Well, that's how you know the arrow is no longer in control of its flight path back to the ground. Gravity has won.
Okay. And that has more to do with spin. Does the amount of helical on that matter?
Yes. Yeah. So if you put like four blazers back there or four really high, long feathers, sometimes got a lot of drag, a lot of grip in the air, you'll have that issue. But I would argue that the vast majority of people running an AAE vane, a normal AAE vane, a blazer, a boning, anything, a tack vane, I see very little parachuting with a three-style fletch. I don't care how much helical you put on there. I see very little parachuting out to normal 40, 45, 50-yard hunting distances. It's when people start putting four fletch on there of a really high profile or a really grabby feather. You know, really like a 3-inch feather, a 4-inch feather, something like that. You put that in a four fletch out there, and yes, it's a good chance that you're going to have parachuting after 40 yards.
I'm losing confidence in myself as we speak.
I'm not saying it's a guarantee,
I know.
But you I know. Will notice like parachuting and other things like that, where the arrow, you know, starts to slow down more aggressively than it launched. You'll notice downrange. It's not something you have to fix. You just have to be aware of,
gotcha.
You know, because it could very well be that it doesn't parachute till 60 yards. Well, I don't know about you. I can't shoot an animal at 60 yards. Oh, yeah. So if it's going to parachute at 60, big whoopee-doo, I'll kill an animal at 45. And that's the end of that. It's very rare that I see people have a parachuting problem. And because eventually all bows will eventually parachute.
Yeah.
right? You go watch guys attack events, and eventually that arrow gets about 70 yards out, 80 yards out, and eventually just, woo, there it goes, because that's physics. You can't stop the physics.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Broadheads, arrows, fletchings. Third access. I want to talk a little bit about the third access on sites. Was it 2 years ago before I got my new site? Something happened and a bolt came loose and I didn't identify it. And I was shooting high right at close range. At 40 yards, I was dead on. But high right on my 30 and 20 and low left on my 50 and 60. All right. And so I'm curious, why do they manufacture third access when you attach it to your bow, that should be rock solid? Why would a person need to adjust that?
So there's three axes that come, right? You have first, second, and third axis, which that's anything in a three-dimensional space. Second axis and third axis are what archers really should be worried about. Second axis is how that sight looks in front of you, pitched like a circle. Mm-hmm. That's a huge one. What you're describing actually is almost the second axis issue, where it's, again, doing that walking thing, where it's, you know, high one direction, low one direction. It just kind of looks like the further you go out, the more it goes to the left or to the right. That could actually be your second axis with how that bubble is shifted left and right in your sight housing. But third axis is elevated, for elevated shots. So third axis is when I am pointing my bow up or I'm pointing my bow down, you've now taken the sight out of level. What I mean by that is now the sight is no longer perpendicular to the ground, perpendicular to the ground. So now the earth, when you're in perpendicular to the ground, you're just dealing with the left and right of the earth. That's, and the earth is level, you're level, everything's fine. But as soon as you point up and you point down, now you have vertical travel of the bubble and the left and right travel of the bubble. So as a tree stand hunter, predominantly we're pointing down. Sometimes the guys out west need to worry about pointing up, but we're pointing down here in the whitetail woods. So when you point down, if that housing actually, the third axis is if it's pitched towards you or if it's pitched away from you. And that is huge because that has to change based on the archer. We all grip the bow different. Our draw lengths are all different. How far away the sight is from our face and from our eye is different. We have to mess with that third axis because as soon as we tip out of the hips and we point the bow down, if we don't have that worked on how our grip torques the riser and how it pushes that sight in and out away from our face, now we've changed the bubble. So now the bubble looks different. Now we tip this way or we tip the other way. We throw off second and third axis and we hit the deer in the butt while it runs off. So that second and third axis is just as important as actually tuning the rest and doing all those things. Because when you actually are in a situation where those levels need to actually be level to the earth, if you put them out of level, the arrow's not going to fly straight, yeah, and you're not going to have a successful shot that range.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots to think about. Lots to think about. And this is what I always tell somebody. Maybe you have a different view, but like I always question my ability to tune my bow and make adjustments. So that is why I have always taken my bow to someone who knows what the hell they're doing and or gets paid to do those things. Now, not all bow techs are created equal, as you probably know.
Painfully.
Yeah. So any other tips or tricks or advice that you would give to someone right now who might be struggling with their accuracy or struggling with tuning their setup this close to opening day?
There is no shame, and I say this to everybody, there is no shame in getting close but not being there and putting a mechanical broadhead on. Mm-hmm. There is no shame. I want to make this very clear. Guys were like, I want to shoot a fixed blade. I want to make it to work. I see, you know, you, Nate, on YouTube. I see other people on YouTube. I hear about my buddies. And I don't think a mechanic will work. And I'm here to tell you, a mechanical broadhead will work just dang fine. Yeah. If you can't get it, you're just like, my fixed blades just aren't flying with my field points. There is no shame in getting it close and then putting on a mechanical broadhead. I want to make that very clear to people that go ahead, go do it. It's not that big of a deal. You will be just fine. But let's say you're just having an overall accuracy issue. completely take whitetail distances out of the factor and go stand at 5 yards, five stinking yards. Go stand at 5 yards and just put them into, don't reside in, just hold your pin on stuff and see where everything lands. And just make sure it's consistently landing. Don't aim at the same spot. You're going to break arrows. Aim at the same, at different spots, and just work at 5 yards. Then work at 7 yards. Then work at 10 yards. And you'd be amazed how fickle you'll be with yourself when you're trying to put your pin on a little piece of canvas that's on your target or your burlap or your foam or whatever you're shooting at.
Yeah.
Do that for a while, and you'll be amazed how that can translate then to 20 yards when you're ready to go step back out there. I've been shooting a bow for 20 years, over 21 years now, almost at a very high level for the past decade. There are days where I still need to do that. And I wish people would be less scared of, oh, I'm in a regression. No, you're not. Sometimes you just need a new breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
And that allows you then to play them with your grip too, with a target that close. You can try really torquing the grip one way or the other, massing your face into the kisser button, and see how that changes your accuracy. And at 5 yards, if you see it change, what do you think it's going to do at 20? So it allows you to have a very controlled environment and a very positive feedback environment. We all hate it when it's at 20 yards and we miss. And we're just like, man, I suck. I'm terrible. Well, you miss at 5 yards, you're missing by like a quarter inch, half yeah. inch, 2 inches. Yeah. And you're like, okay, I know I need to work on that. But your brain tells you, good shot, you didn't miss.
Yeah.
So that's real key, because 90% of bow hunting is right in between the ears. And 10% is that animal standing downrange.
Yeah. And to look at it, though, from a different light, like I feel like I'm a good bow hunter, but I'm a shitty archer. So
yeah,
those things do not go, like, you're not supposed to say that, right? And so I have always, every year when I get the time, I always try to become a little bit better of an archer every single year and take on some type of new, even though my new goal of becoming a better archer. And then, like, my woodsmanship's there. I know I'm going to run into deer. It's just a matter of getting my equipment where I want it. Like, I want to be, what's that dude's name from Lord of the Rings? I want to be Legolas or whatever, that elf. He's like shooting, he's shooting orcs in the eye from like 300 yards. That's what I want to be like.
That's fantastic. I think I'd rather just be Gimli, just a little short bearded guy with an axe.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Throwing axes at animals.
Throwing axes at deer. Just got it. Just a giant dwarf.
Do you remember that Rage Broadhead commercial from back in the day where the guy's like, it's like throwing an axe through an animal?
Yeah. I do remember that.
How cool would it be to actually have a primitive weapon season? Because a primitive weapon season includes like atlatls and crossbows and things like that. And you could just, you could jump out of a tree stand with an axe, like some Viking, and just completely.
Think it'd be cool to do throwing knives.
Oh, throwing
again, knives. But like throwing knives would be interesting. There's a lot of guys that are actually very effective with throwing knives.
Yeah.
That could be a very interesting, very interesting thing. But man, the number of people that can't hit the broadside of a bar with a compound bow. Let's just stick with that for
stick
now.
Stick with that. How about we start working on our compound bows, right? There you go. There you go. Hey, Nate, man, I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for the conversation today, and good luck this upcoming season.
Absolutely, man. Same to you.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.